Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 27th of December, these are our main stories. Israel says its airstrikes have hit tunnels containing the Hamas headquarters in Jabalia, northern Gaza.
We can't accept Hamas's terms. We can't accept their rules of the game. Letting Hamas survive is just a recipe for more violence down the road.
And the pull of the war in Ukraine reaches to Nepal's Himalayan valleys.
People are said to be charging up to $9,000 to recruit these young Nepali men so that they go via India or through the Middle East to Russia and fight as mercenaries for the Russian army.
Also in this podcast, dozens of barnacle-encrusted packages of cocaine wash up on beaches in Australia, and the impact of book bans on school children across the US.
When you ban these books because of that reason, they look at that and they say, am I being banned? Am I not appropriate for people to read?
The Israeli military is keeping up its offensive across the Gaza Strip, shifting most of its focus now to southern and central areas. It claims to have carried out strikes on at least 200 Hamas targets in the past 24 hours. Israel admits the war could last many more months. Mark Regev, a senior advisor to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, says the fighting has to persist until Hamas is eliminated.
We can't destroy Hamas's ideology, unfortunately. That's not realistic. But we can remove them from power. We can prevent them from having control over this territorial enclave. And that will do a lot to save lives and prevent future conflict in the region. And they know the only way to save themselves and their regime of terror is to have pressure for a ceasefire. But everyone, if one talks about moral leadership, we can't accept Hamas's terms. We can't accept their rules of the game. Letting Hamas survive is just a recipe for more violence down the road.
Meanwhile, the suffering of ordinary Palestinians continues. The Hamas-run health ministry says almost 200 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza over the past 2 days. The Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Mohammed Shetaya, described Israel as a criminal, outlawed state. He said he was asking the International Criminal Court to start legal action against those he said were responsible for committing crimes against the Palestinian people. Juliet Toomer is from the UN's main relief agency for Palestinians, UNRWA. She says the lack of humanitarian aid reaching the people of Gaza remains a huge problem.
Very little supplies continue to come into the Gaza Strip, and there needs to be more aid. And I can speak to the aid that UNRWA receives. We do know that it's very, very little, and it doesn't correspond to the ongoing and increasing humanitarian needs on the ground in Gaza. Gaza used to get every single day 500 trucks of humanitarian aid, of fuel, and of commercial supplies. In no day during this war have we reached anything close to that. On average, we're still receiving around 100 on a good day. And so much more needs to happen and be done to get to the levels of pre-war.
I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yoland Nell, about the current situation in Gaza.
The reports we're hearing, Israel is continuing to bomb parts of the north of the Gaza Strip where it has said it has operational control. We heard that one of its latest strikes in Jabalia was targeting an underground tunnel headquarters belonging to Hamas. But really, its intense ground offensive continues, particularly in Khan Yunis in the very south of the Strip. And now it's expanded into another part of the territory in the middle of the Gaza Strip where residents have been told to evacuate a belt, the width of the centre of Gaza, people told to move to nearby Deir al-Balah. And we've had the UN, a senior official, warning that this is something gravely concerning because already we have so many displaced people in this area, people who relocated from the north in particular in search of refuge.
And the situation in the West Bank?
And in the West Bank, we've had overnight an Israeli raid on an urban refugee camp close to Tulkarm, with six people killed, according to Palestinian health officials. They claim there was an Israeli drone strike. The Israeli military hasn't yet commented. But really, it's an indication, again, of just how violence has flared in the West Bank since the 7th of October attacks on Israel. More than 300 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health there. And this comes after the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas gave his first interview since the start of the war yesterday and did warn that the West Bank was at risk of implosion, he said.
And the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu under enormous pressure from the hostages' families.
That's right. There was another demonstration that took place last night. You know, there's international pressure on Israel from its closest ally from the US to lower the intensity of operations in Gaza to reduce civilian deaths. But at home, what is really chiming with the sympathies of the Israeli public are these relatives of the 100 plus hostages still held in Gaza with so little information really coming through about what's happened to them. They have accused their government of not doing enough to bring their loved ones home. And there has been talk, of course, of Egypt in particular trying to mediate another deal to reach at least a humanitarian pause in Gaza. But so far, those talks with Egypt mediating between Israel and Hamas haven't come to any kind of conclusion. The idea would be that there could be a halt in the fighting that could bring more hostages out of Gaza and take more aid in.
Yoland Nell. Ukraine says Russian forces have attacked a railway station in the southern port city of Kherson, where civilians were waiting to board an evacuation train. The Ukrainian Interior Minister said one person was killed and four others were wounded. Kherson has been repeatedly targeted by Russian forces since Ukraine recaptured it late last year. I got the latest from our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse.
Shelling is a part of daily life for people who live in Kherson, really, since it was liberated last year. I think the number of casualties appears quite low, thankfully, against the large numbers of people who were reportedly gathering at the station. Police have been credited by the authorities for helping get people out, but a police officer is rumoured to have lost their life in the attack. Now, the authorities are saying it was an evacuation train. This is a train route which was established almost immediately after Kherson was liberated when Russian forces retreated across the Dnipro River. But what has followed is that the Russians re-established their positions and they have launched artillery strikes on the city across residential areas and suburbs close to the river on a daily basis. And when you go there, the level of threat that people live with is always quite surprising. And what they tell you is that living there now is still better than living under occupation. That's the kind of broad sentiment among those who have stayed, but there is a strain that comes with living close to the front line, and this is a reminder of the very real risks that they live with.
Of course, this strike on the railway station comes after Ukraine launched a successful attack on a Russian warship in the Black Sea. Is there any suggestion that this could be retaliation?
No, and I don't think it'll ever be possible to make that link. It is true that both sides have staged more spectacular attack, shall we say, when the other has enjoyed success on the battlefield. But if you look at the pattern of Russia's tactics in its continued invasion, it launches artillery strikes, drone attacks on settlements right across the front line, as well as close to the Russian border. It has always adopted this strategy of trying to suppress the local populations. However, the attack on this major landing ship in Crimea is a welcome bit of good news for Kyiv. You know, the damage is undeniable. The explosion was colossal, and it will no doubt hamper Russian operations to an extent. But for Ukraine, it's very much playing the long game and trying to undermine Russian control in the Crimean Peninsula as well as the Black Sea. For now, it changes very little on the front line, where it is Russia making wave after wave of attack and most recently claiming to have captured the eastern city of Marinka, which Ukraine disputes, but we are still talking about a city of which there is barely anything left. Like all other settlements on the front line, it's been reduced to rubble.
James Waterhouse. As the crow flies, it's just over 5,000 kilometres from the flatlands of Kherson's Dnieper Valley to the Himalayan peaks of Nepal and its capital, Kathmandu. But today comes news that shows just how far the shockwaves of the war in Ukraine have reverberated, with reports that about 100 young men from Nepal who'd signed up to fight for Russia are missing in action or wounded.
How they got there is a story in itself. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etarajan in Delhi told me more.
Many young Nepalese are looking for opportunities to go abroad, either to work or even to study or on a visit as well. Now, according to the Nepali officials, many of these dozens of people who went to Russia, they volunteered themselves because they are giving some inducements like money or residency permits. So they have reportedly joined Russian army as mercenaries fighting in the front line. And the Nepali foreign minister, N.P. Saud, says that these 100 people are either missing or wounded and some of them are captured. And so Nepal has raised this issue with Russia, saying that they should not be recruiting Nepali citizens to fight because this is causing a lot of concern for the families back at home as well. But it is also part of the human trafficking ring because people are said to be charging up to $9,000 to recruit these young Nepali men so that they go via India or through the Middle East to Russia and fight as mercenaries for the Russian army.
So how much do we know of what has actually happened to these Nepalese fighters?
When I met the Nepalese foreign minister a couple of months ago in Kathmandu, he was talking about dozens of people are worried about the loved ones who went there to fight. And that time itself, he was saying about 7 people reportedly killed and their families had no information about the loved ones who went to fight in Ukraine or went to Russia either to study. And now it's a big concern for Nepal itself because they don't allow anyone to go and fight for other countries except for India and Britain because of the ancient treaties and as Gurkhas are allowed to fight in the militaries. And many of the relatives are now coming forward and complaining with the Nepali government that our relatives are there. So it is a job of the Nepal's government to bring them back. At the same time, the Nepali police have also arrested more than a dozen people suspected of trafficking these men to Russia. But however, they insist that so far they have not found any direct involvement of Russia in recruiting these people.
Anbarasan Etarajan in Delhi. In the past year, the US has seen a record number of book bans, many of them in schools, affecting millions of children across the country. Those calling for the bans say they're protecting children from unsuitable content, but campaigners say it's stifling free speech. Annie Fromion reports from St. Petersburg in Florida, the state with the highest number of book bans.
I know Charlotte's Web has been banned because they said it was unnatural for animals to be speaking English.
Grace, who is 12, is showing me books on a shelf in her bedroom.
Magnus Chase and the Hammer of Thor and Magnus Chase and the Ship of the Dead, those two have been banned.
For a class project, she's built a free book exchange in front of her school. She's asking the public to donate banned books, 2,532 to be precise. That's the number of book restrictions PEN America, which campaigns for freedom of expression in literature, counted in the United States last year.
It hurts the kids too, like, because they might come from backgrounds that are the content that's being banned. They might come from backgrounds with 2 parents of the same gender, different ethnicities, different races. And then when you ban these books because of that reason, they look at that and they say, am I being banned? Am I not appropriate for people to read?
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the District Instructional Materials Review Committee.
I'm at a Pinellas County School District meeting for The Lovely Bones by Alice Siebold. There was a complaint against the book made in August, which meant it was taken off the shelves in all of the district schools. It's being discussed now, months later, to see if it can return. The challenger believes the text violates one of Florida's obscenity laws and shouldn't be distributed. What's caused the most confusion is House Bill 1069, which prohibits materials in schools that contain sexual conduct. But because the term is so vague, there are even schools that have preemptively pulled books as they don't want to face criminal charges.
Books like this have zero educational value. It's not
like I meet Angela Dubach, who is challenging the book. She's from Moms for Liberty. It's a national conservative campaign group. She says The Lovely Bones is inappropriate for middle schoolers. That's ages 11 and up. The book deals with a teenager's rape and murder.
My objection was based on the fact that it's very, very sexual explicit, and I don't think that's appropriate for minors. If you have to rely on a book to help you deal with something, I just kind of have a problem with that. I just think that that's a parental thing. You know, if your child is raped or killed or whatever, like, That's, you got to deal with that as a parent. It doesn't make sense to me to turn to a book to ease your pain.
Florida is responsible for more than 40% of the book bans in the United States. This is the highest number out of any state. The vast majority are coming from a few conservative counties and are requested by only a few individuals.
It's been so divisive and honestly very hurtful to librarians who really...
Chris Smith is the president of the Florida Association of Media and Education. They're a group of librarians and media specialists who have a role in making book suggestions.
We are doing everything we can to improve literacy and trying to increase stamina of reading right now, which, you know, the learning loss from COVID, which was already starting to kind of happen, but the ability for a student to really read a chapter book, that really should be concerning to everybody. We need to be worried about getting kids to read in depth and breadth. It should be on everybody's radar kind of more than one paragraph that bothers you.
Campaigners say book bans have hit record highs this year in Florida and across the U.S. They worry that efforts to restrict books, so far largely focused on schools, will also spread to public libraries and further deepen America's cultural divisions.
Annie Fromion with that report. Still to come in this podcast, like a phoenix from the ashes, the return of Mexico's state airline, Mexicana.
And what's interesting is it's controlled by the armed forces. And the armed forces, they have been gaining access to new areas.
Remarkable personal stories.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
Deep dive documentaries.
These children are using their own bags, not to carry books, but they carry the drug markets in Sweden on their shoulders.
And sport, but not as you know it.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
The BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for Lives Less Ordinary, The Documentary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Sudan, 8 months of fighting between the army and the powerful paramilitary force known as the RSF have caused one of the largest displacements of people anywhere in the world. More than 6.5 million people are estimated to have fled their homes. Many more are trapped in the war zone with very little to survive on. Aid agencies have struggled to access the areas where most of the fighting has been going on and are warning that the crisis could soon deteriorate rapidly. The BBC's Anne Soy has been hearing from a family that's been trapped for months in the crossfire in the capital, Khartoum.
You can see my baby's bed over there. A part of the missile came through the AC.
That's Rasha Amin. She's showing me via virtual video the damage a missile strike caused. It was aimed at her neighbor's house, which had been taken over by armed men. Luckily, no one in her home got injured.
We're still scared because we have to put our mattresses on the floor, away from the windows. We hear their machine guns around us, so we have to stay as safe as possible.
Her 5-year-old son interrupts the call. The war has had an impact on him.
After that shock, he started to wet his bed, and now he cries every night because he saw a nightmare or he's scared.
The grass keeps pinching his feet.
The family has only left their home once during the war. Russia's husband, Mohammed, is London-born. He's a British citizen, and so are her children. So when evacuations were announced, they hoped to get out of Sudan. But their hopes were quashed when they got there.
The officer, he said, the husband can go and the kids can go and leave me behind. So we decided to stay.
Russia tells me they've written multiple emails to different offices in the UK, but only get automated messages back. They are stuck in the war zone with limited supplies. The conflict has now spread to Gezira State, the country's breadbasket and one of the last remaining sanctuaries for displaced Sudanese.
Nearly 18 million people, that's a population the size of the Netherlands, are now facing acute hunger.
That's the World Food Programme's spokesperson for Sudan, Lenny Kinsley.
Now what is going to happen if farmers are also forced to flee? And what does that mean for food availability across the country? So the catastrophic hunger that we were warning about before could be even worse with the impacts of the conflict in this Sudan's breadbasket.
Talks aimed at finding a political solution have not gone far. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the country's de facto leader and head of the army, has vowed to fight to victory or death. His rival, who heads the powerful paramilitary force RSF, has been gaining ground. The group has been accused of carrying out ethnic cleansing in the western region of Darfur, claims RSF denies. The American and British governments have said both sides have committed war crimes. Here's the UK Minister for Africa, Andrew Mitchell.
Well, we will do everything we can, along with our allies and like-minded people, to bring those who perpetrate any form of human rights abuse and breaches of international humanitarian law to account.
It's been described as a senseless war. Millions of civilians have been caught in the middle, lost everything, and fled, or, like Russia, remain trapped in the war zone.
Anne Soy reporting. Sand, shells, seaweed, just some of the souvenirs you might well expect to pick up on a trip to the beach. But some members of the public in the Australian state of New South Wales got a bit more than they bargained for during their seaside visit, as our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton explains.
Police have had a very busy Christmas period, Alex. That's because just before Christmas, packages containing cocaine started washing up on beaches in New South Wales. Every day, it seems, a few more packages have arrived. Two quite large shipments, 39 packages in total in two different places have arrived. So totaling 124 kilograms of cocaine have washed up on beaches in one area. That's got a street value of around $33 million. So that's kept police busy looking for extra packages of cocaine themselves and also appealing to the public to turn any other packages that wash up into the police so that they can submit them for forensic testing and try to figure out who's behind all of this cocaine.
What are the police saying?
They're really concerned that this is just one small tip of the iceberg, really, when it comes to cocaine trafficking in Australia. You know, police seizures of cocaine more than doubled in 2023 in Australia. That's because it's really a lucrative market for cocaine. And so they suspect that traffickers are really just doing whatever they can to try to get the drug into the country. They say traffickers' methodologies, the way that they ship cocaine, is constantly changing in order to evade police. So sometimes they use couriers on board cruise ships to try to carry the drugs into the country. Sometimes they attach the goods to the hulls of ships. Sometimes they even just do drops at sea, and then people in boats try to go out and try to retrieve the cocaine. That's possibly where these shipments of cocaine that have been washing up on coastline really came from.
Celia Hatton. The authorities in South Korea have confirmed that the actor Lee Sun-hyun, best known for his role in the Oscar-winning social satire Parasite, has been found dead in an apparent suicide. Police say they found his body in his car in one of Seoul's main parks. He'd recently been questioned by police investigating alleged illegal drug use. In 2020, Parasite made history at the Oscars, becoming the first international film to win Best Picture. The BBC's Nick Marsh is in Seoul and told me more.
Before finding this body in a park in Seoul, which has been now confirmed to us to be the body of Lee Sun-kyun, the actor, the police had received a report that he'd left his house and he'd left some kind of memo, which appears to be a suicide note. Now, I say appears because we haven't had the cause of death confirmed yet by the police or any authorities, but it is being reported as an apparent suicide. But I should stress, right now, we don't know the exact cause, but that's the way it's being reported in local media.
Because it's also reported he was being investigated for drug offences, which is very serious in South Korea, isn't it?
Yes, he was. Since October, he's been under investigation by the police for alleged drug use. Now, we're talking about a huge star here, you know, in Lee Sun-kyun. The story was that he'd been visiting a hostess bar, which is quite salacious in and of itself. Now, he doesn't deny that. What he does deny is that he was taking drugs there. And like you said, drug use is very serious in South Korea. You can get a quite substantial jail time, even for just using a small amount. Now, the allegation was that he'd been using ketamine, marijuana. Lee said that he didn't know what he was taking was drugs, and he actually said he'd been blackmailed. Now, that ended up with questioning by the police, and over the weekend there was this marathon session of questioning, 19 hours overnight. And that is the last we know of this case until we found out this sad news this morning.
Because he really was a huge star, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a household name. Even before Parasite, Lee Sung-kyun was a leading man in rom-coms, in dramas, in TV shows. Everything obviously changed for him in terms of his international fame when he played the role of the father in the Park family in Parasite. You know, that smash hit movie directed by Bong Joon-ho in 2019. It's a social satire about wealth inequality in South Korea. It won the Oscar for Best Picture. You know, that really put him on the world stage. But here in South Korea, you know, he was this squeaky clean family man. He was the face of several brands here. They dropped him, the brands, once these drug investigation reports started to emerge. He actually had a show which was due for release soon as well. There's talk that that could have been pulled as well. So, you know, we're really talking about a man who's had his life turned upside down in the past 3 months. And he's not the only celebrity to be investigated for drug use. We know that the government here is starting to crack down harder and harder on drugs. And high profile names like Lee's have been appearing in news reports and police investigations.
Nick Marsh in Seoul. For many years, any self-respecting country wanted its own national airline, its state-owned flag carrier. But in recent times, airlines from different countries have been coming together under a single brand. Now, Mexico is bucking the trend by relaunching Mexicana, nearly 20 years after it was privatised. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, told us why.
Well, that's very much part of the vision of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's a man who believes in this big state project, in the state leading the development. So the company went bankrupt a while ago after being privatized, and they bought it back from the owners in August for about $50 million. He says an airline like that will run to places where the commercial airlines don't want to go. Also, there are airports, small airports that are being built by the government that will be used by them. So in a way, they will provide a cheaper service and will help develop those regions. The first flight was from Mexico City, a new airport built outside Mexico City, to the resort city of Tulum near Cancun on the Caribbean coast. And that's where the president a week ago was inaugurating, opening his Maya train, which is also a big project in the region. There was a time when most countries had their own national airline. Many countries also thought that if they didn't have, the security was threatened. So, of course, that's not the case anymore. I mean, Mexicana is a small airline at the moment. It has only 3 airplanes. It will buy another 10 airplanes next year. So it won't cover the whole demand for flights in Mexico, but it will give the government some power as well. And what's interesting is it's controlled by the armed forces. And the armed forces, they have been gaining access to new areas in Mexico where they didn't have a say. For example, national parks. They were involved, of course, in tackling the drug gangs, but also controlling airports and airlines.
Leonardo Rocha. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa, and the producer was Anna Murphy. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.